Hey Will.
Hey Rohan, how you doing?
Very well, thanks. Very well. How are you?
Yeah, good. And I should be saying Happy New Year as well.
Yeah, Happy New Year to you. Well, Happy New Year's Eve special.
Yeah. It's been a little while since we've done one of these.
Yeah. Maybe it should be our New Year resolution to like film one every week.
I think that's probably a good one.
Hopefully it'll actually work on like all my other New Year's resolutions.
So do you typically have one or two that you do make and try and stick to?
Yeah, I think I tend to do reasonably well, but I tend to peter out by the second quarter of the year.
Okay.
I'm trying to think what it, for this year it was read one book a week.
Okay.
I was doing pretty well for the first 4 or 5 months. And then it just kind of ended up being one a fortnight, then one a month.
Yeah.
By the end of it, which, yeah, it's still pretty good.
Yeah. I guess the idea is to try and turn it into just a habitual behavior. And if you're still doing one a fortnight, that's still a good behavior to have developed.
Yeah, it just feels like a failure because when you set yourself such high goals, then it becomes difficult to kind of stay with them. Perhaps I should have said maybe go for one a fortnight and then go up to one a week next year. So maybe we should do one once a fortnight.
Okay, yeah. Baby steps and then work our way up.
Do you have them?
So I think when I was younger, we all went around the family saying, what's your New Year's resolution? And you sort of make something up on the spot. But I haven't genuinely made one that I've tried to stick to that I can remember. I don't know. I just never got into it.
I had one friend at uni who used to say my New Year's resolution is to not have a New Year's resolution.
Well, there was always the joke of my New Year's resolution is to not go to school, but that one was never really carried out, sadly.
Yeah, why is it that like very few people actually, because I think if you ask anyone, but very few people, almost pretty much no one I know says, yep, I completed my New Year's resolution at the end of the year.
Yeah,
most people are probably like that, which they can't forget. They forget what it even was.
Yeah, but maybe, I mean, it might just be that the New Year's resolution is more, potentially it's more an American thing, and so it's in films and stuff, but maybe not actually carried out that much. Or maybe people are just, bad at seeing it through.
Yeah, I think like there's certain industries that take big advantage of this. So like gyms, for example, rely on the whole New Year, New Me thing, and they have like, I think their business model is actually structured so that if everyone who booked at a gym actually went there, then they'd like lose out massively.
Yeah, and obviously their capacity could never manage. They're always going to want more members than their gym has capacity for, right? Otherwise, they're going to be really limited in terms of how many people they can actually take on.
So yeah, I suppose New Year's resolutions are a strange thing, but anyway, let's move on to what we're here about. So what do we got for us today?
Yeah, so, before we talk too much about plans for next year, we wanted to talk a bit about what happened this year in the sort of the university applications space, because it wasn't a typical year by any stretch. But there were some particular things that stood out for us, as we were working with students and with schools and with universities. So, now's a good time to reflect on that and then maybe think how it might look next year as well. Because of course, the problems that occurred this year are not necessarily solved, but they're not necessarily as bad as they were as well. So, we'll have a little talk about that. And so, interviews, tests, overall applications, what everything means, that there's a lot that was different this year than has been, in a traditional historic application process.
Yeah, definitely. Where's the first place? I guess it's probably useful to kind of give listeners some context as to typically how most universities that our students tend to apply to tend to work with, which tends to be principally Oxford, Cambridge, and medical schools and law schools.
Yeah.
And the way we tend to break it down historically has always been like, if you imagine a pie chart, There's four segments to it.
Mm-hmm.
Three of the segments contribute 30% each, and then the final segment contributes
10%. I don't know if you can hear my dog there. He should be fine now.
Okay. Yeah, so essentially there's four segments, and the three segments that contribute 30% each, historically we've said, are your GCSEs, the admissions test scores, and interviews, and then everything else is 10%. Traditionally, obviously there's exceptions depending on the specific college you're applying to. If you're applying to my college, for instance, for medicine, then your BMAT score contributes to 50%. Mm. Other courses may not even have an admissions test, so obviously those segments get changed, but broadly speaking, those are accurate. But there were some pretty radical changes that were kind of brought about as a result of what's been going on in the world. Probably where should we start?
Well, so I think the biggest one, or potentially the most shocking one, is probably about GCSEs, right? Historically, everyone's thought that, everyone minimizes the effect of the test and the interviews and think, actually, it's all about my grades. If I have good grades, I'll get in. And we have quite a hard job of actually explaining to people, well, no, there's a lot else that these universities are interested in. They're not just looking at your grades from 3 years ago. And that's been made even more clear by Oxford saying that they actually haven't looked at, and I think they weren't evaluating the GCSEs at all this year, at least.
Yeah, which is just unthinkable, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah.
But it makes sense, right? Like, I mean, if in their eyes, if a student's not earned in inverted commas the grade, then it makes sense that they won't consider it.
Well, but absolutely, it's very understandable. And actually, we've been saying this all year, right? We've been saying, look, Oxford now, the only standardized test that they have to evaluate you all on is your admissions test. They no longer have the GCSE, so almost forget about them. And we've been saying that all year because we could predict, based on what we know they're going to be looking at and how they evaluate things, that the GCSEs would be worthless. And now they've effectively admitted that and said, yeah, we changed our process in order to take into consideration the fact that, yeah, these grades aren't the reliable indicator of skill and academics that they once were. And, lots of people will be very happy having got many A stars at GCSE. And that is, that's good, but it's important to understand that it means that it's no longer the tool that it once was.
Yeah, and it's not just GCSEs, it's also A-levels, right? I mean, if we just look at A-levels as a predictor of kind of grade inflation, actually, if we go all the way back to 2000, about 18% of grades that were awarded were A's.
Yeah.
And principally that rose to about 25% in 2019. So it was about, it was pretty much holding. There was a little bit of inflation, but 7% over 19 years isn't crazy.
Mm.
But this year alone, the number of A-level grades awarded A or A star was 45%.
Yeah.
So that's pretty much double almost.
Mm.
And a similar pattern was observed with GCSEs. So it's no wonder that Oxford had to be much more selective as a result.
Yeah. And it's interesting because they brought in, for the GCSEs at least, they brought in that numbered system a few years ago. And I had thought, you might correct me on this, I had thought that the point of the numbered system was to sort of stretch the distribution of grades out a bit more to sort of separate out students. But it seems that obviously they weren't expecting the pandemic, but in just a few years, the point of that has been completely, pointless because the grades have just inflated anyway.
Yeah, and I think, I don't know if you ever read the kind of articles that come out on results day, but it's always like terribly reported. It's always like the government's either failing kids or things are way, way too easy now compared to how they used to be, depending on which paper you read. And if you look at the numbers and the margins, it tends to be, percentage of A grades have gone from 19% to 19.4% or something.
Mm.
Like, it's minuscule margins. But the news seemed to make a big deal of it. But this year, there's been barely any mention of the fact that twice as many students are getting top grades?
Yeah, I don't know if, because last year it was a very sensitive topic around the way that grades were given. And there was a lot, I don't know if they're just avoiding it completely now. But yeah, you know, my problem with last year was people were upset that the algorithm was wrong maybe 30% of the time. Whereas I was pulling my hair out saying, well, predicted grades are wrong all of the time. So, you know, at least it's slightly better.
I think the work we did showed that it was about 80% of predicted grades are wrong, that they're too high.
Which is crazy. But I guess the big question is, you know, the people who applied this year, it's happened. They can't really do anything about it. The big question is next year, are they going to swing back completely? Are they going to, you know, to taking on GCSE grades? Are they going to take them on, but with slightly less emphasis? Because the students next year will have actually sat GCSEs, I think, because they will have sat them this.
No, they didn't summer. Take place this year, did they?
Well, then the problem continues. But, you know, obviously we're thinking about last year's application. For those students that have done that, it doesn't really matter anymore, right? They're hopefully going to be getting good news in the new year, and they've done all the work that they can. But for people applying to next year, you know, they didn't sit their GCSEs either. So the question is, well, I think the answer is that Oxford is going to carry on this policy.
They have to, right? I guess.
Yeah.
Like there's no other way. I mean, the only other way to do it would be to introduce another test, but it doesn't make sense if you already have one. We'll come on to why it might be worth doing.
It
might be worth doing based on some of the things that happened with the BMAT this year, but that's a different story.
Yeah, and we'll talk about that, I'm sure. But, you know, I think that is a huge, for students that are thinking of applying to Oxford, that is a huge piece of information that if you don't know, could seriously skew the way that you approach this application, right? Because firstly, you might think, well, my GCSEs are perfect. I'll be fine elsewhere, which is obviously a really bad way of approaching it. But on the other side, you could also be thinking, well, my GCSEs were pretty rubbish. You know, I was pretty poorly graded by my teachers. They sort of expected little of me anyway, so they gave me low grades. That means that it's all off. But actually, it kind of doesn't matter what GCSE grades you got, which is something which hasn't really happened before. You know, that they've mattered to varying degrees, but they've never not mattered at all. So next year will definitely be very interesting. And I'd hope that there are more ambitious students who make more applications because they know if I do well on this test, then, you know, the admissions test, then you're in. Well, you've got a very good chance of being in.
Yeah, so fundamentally, nothing's likely to change for Oxford. What do you think about Cambridge? I've seen pretty much the same processes this year.
Well, I think I'd anticipate yes. You know, the reason why Oxford normally evaluates the GCSE so highly is because, of course, they don't interview many people.
Yeah, I mean, on that note, a lot of our students have had interviews from Oxford, more than we would have projected for. And a similar thing happened last year. And I just wonder if, I don't know this, maybe you will, but is there a reason why Oxford don't interview as many people? Because I've always put it down to the logistical difficulties of being interviewed at two different colleges and therefore having to have accommodation arranged, etc. But now that interviews are online, does that mean that Oxford are interviewing more people? I mean, the stats aren't out yet, so we can't confirm, but is that a reasonable thing to assume?
So I guess so. You know, my understanding of it was the same as yours. They can't or don't want to interview that many people, whereas my sense was Cambridge put in more effort to make it happen. But you're right.
You're right, isn't it? No. As much as I'd like to dig at Oxford here, but Cambridge, you are being interviewed at one college, whereas Oxford is two. So it's much harder to kind of coordinate timetabling between them.
That is a fair assessment. And thank you for standing up for Oxford. But yeah, moving online does make things easier. It means you can have interviews more frequently in the day. It means you don't have the whole issue of, I'm sure students forget which room to end up in, but you don't have the problem of trying to make sure students are at Balliol in the morning and Magdalen in the afternoon, that kind of thing. So it would be, I'd anticipate they are interviewing more, but then the question is, well, without the logistical problem, would Oxford then just interview as many people as Cambridge do, or would they still, through some sort of tradition, pride, mixture, say, well, no, we don't interview as many. That's a hallmark of us. We'll keep it that way. And again, we don't really know, but it sounds like they might be interviewing at least some more, which is always good. You know, it means that they can evaluate more people and more people get the opportunity.
Yeah, absolutely.
Speaking about online interviews, is there any sense of whether interviews will happen online next year as well? Because that's obviously going to affect this trend that we're noticing.
Yeah. I mean, Oxford and Cambridge are quite far ahead of the game, I think, because I think they announced that interviews would take place online in around July or August. And pretty much everyone was saying, why on earth are they... why are they doing that? So they need to come up and change with the times. Like, every COVID's finished, so then ironically it turned out they were bang on the money.
That is true. And I thought, I think we'd hoped that the interviews would be in person, and I was a bit, well, you know, from a personal point, I really enjoyed my interviews experience, and I thought actually it's a shame for students, whether they get in or not, that they're not able to go to Oxford or Cambridge and sort of just at least experience it for a few days, because that's always really nice. And so when that news came out, I was thinking, well, you know, obviously they've done what they've had to do, but that's disappointing. But you're right, in the end, it ended up being definitely the right thing to do.
Yeah. And I just wonder, you know, how much of that was public health foresight and how much of that was operational ease?
Yeah.
Because it's quite,
I think, a bit of both.
You save a lot of money, of course.
Yeah.
The fact that other universities have all remained online as well, I think speaks volumes. But it's an interesting point as to whether we'll ever go back to in-person interviews, you know, next year, for instance.
And again, the problem is, you know, if we did online interviews, given how good things were looking sort of in the summer, and there were times when things were looking pretty good from a COVID perspective, then even if next year is looking pretty good, again, it's likely that they'll just do it online again, which has big implications, you know, more people being interviewed, GCSEs not being looked at. So the COVID itself makes a huge difference to the application process, more so than I think people realize.
We're so early into the pandemic that, you know, I hope we're not, but, you know, assuming we are, there's pretty much no research, as far as I know, on how likely you are to get a spot based on the strength of your internet connection, for instance, or the quality of your webcam. And all of these things are very difficult to standardize for. So it just introduces an extra variable into the equation, because, yeah, pre-pandemic, the thing that students used to get most stressed about was, what do I wear?
What to wear, yeah.
Whereas now, actually, it's what camera or what model of tablet I should use.
And it's interesting because, of course, you know, if you go to a nice enough school, they'll probably be able to find a room in the school that you can use, which is quiet and away from everyone, and has a sign outside saying, you know, do not disturb, examination in progress. But you might go to a school that just doesn't have the space or the capacity to be able to do that. So you then have to do it at home, where, you know, you've probably got siblings running around and pets and things like that. And again, that's something which was standardized when it was in person, because you were all in the same room, all, you know, with the same things going on around you, whereas you lose that. You'd hope that the Oxbridge dons are sort of sensible enough to be able to filter those kind of things out. But, you know, as you know, it's impossible to not have biases one way or another.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I do know that Oxford and Cambridge do try pretty hard to kind of make sure that people who don't have the correct tech do get it. but it must just be so difficult operationally to kind of make it happen. Last year, I don't know if you remember this, but there was this kind of article about how students were sent a diagram with two tin cans that balanced their smartphone on it to show them diet. I mean, that, I think it was blown out of proportion, but it does it point to how absurd the whole situation was.
But I think, because I think that reflected pretty badly, because wasn't that what was sent from Oxford? And then didn't Cambridge say, we'll send you an iPad or something along those lines? So two very different approaches.
I'm not saying anything.
So I guess we've talked a bit about, you know, you said at the start, those three big things that contribute to a student's application. We talked about the interviews. They're, you know, huge things going on there and still a lot of uncertainty. We talked about the GCSEs. And actually, a lot of certainty on the GCSEs, which is helpful. The last thing is those admissions tests. You know, just there are changes to the admissions tests every year, right? That's nothing too extraordinary. New ones come along, new subjects take them on, changes to the sections, that kind of thing. But this year, I guess the one of the things that went particularly wrong was the BMAT, right?
Yeah, that really couldn't have gone worse, I think. I think if everyone's tests had been nullified, that probably would have almost worked better from what I've heard. So for those listeners who don't know, this is a test used by competitive medical universities like Oxford, Cambridge, UCL, Imperial, and so on. And historically, it's always been run on paper, but this was the second year where it was run online. And it was outsourced to a separate company, and that company essentially put lots of safeguards in, rightly so that the tests couldn't be cheated on. But the safeguards were so secure that essentially prevented the tests from loading on lots of students or timing out or diagrams weren't displaying. We had a huge, I don't know about you, we had a huge number of students calling me saying, I'm stuck in the test center. They've not loaded my test or my diagrams aren't loading. What can I do? When we did the survey last year, I think it was about, I can't remember the numbers off the top of my head now, but I think it was about 40% were affected, whereas I think it was more than 50% this year that were affected. It was a huge proportion. And every university dealt with it differently. But the fact that, and I think more students took the BMAT this year, any other year as well, is kind of the intel we have. That makes things just so much more harder.
I think it's, I thought at the time that it was quite irresponsible of the medical schools who use the BMAT not to all sit down together and say, right, this has gone wrong. What are we going to do about it? Because you had some medical schools saying you'll resit it, some medical schools saying, sorry, that's it. And some saying, you know, don't worry, we're not going to, we'll devalue it in our process. And that's got to be very confusing and very worrying for students, you know, at quite a critical point in their application to have all this different information coming from different places.
Yeah. I don't quite understand the logic of doing it online again for the second. I mean, things were getting better. Even if everything was terrible, it wouldn't be absurd to get everyone in just for 2 hours to kind of just do it on paper.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose, you know, if they weren't doing actually school exams, then I guess, you know, there's a reason to minimizing doing the BMAT exam in person as well. But it does, you know, it causes so much confusion, and it doesn't, you know, I was hoping after last year they'd have sorted it out, but they haven't. And there's no guarantee that they'll sort it out next year either. And so I think whoever's in charge of that decision, I don't know if it's someone on the GMC or the assessments centers or whoever's in charge of it, has got to think, well, if we do it online again, there's a very high chance that it's not going to run smoothly. I think that was probably the problem. They probably thought last year, right, we'll do it online again, and this time it will run smoothly. I think they've got to be more realistic than that and know if we do that, it's going to cause more problems than it's worth.
Yeah. I mean, I suspect there are, you know, other circumstances which we're not aware of. So It can't be that easy having 10,000 students take your test. But I mean, we have a platform that does exactly that. So it's not, it's very much done. Hey, here's the thought. Maybe if they're listening, they should let us take it next year.
Yeah. And, but do you know the company that they took on to do it? Is it an online testing company?
I think it was something called Metal. But I'm not too familiar with them.
I don't know, because you know, if that's all that you do, then and to sort of mess it up that badly is bad.
Yeah, I think what upsets me is the fact it happened twice.
Yeah,
I think once a year you can kind of say, okay, look, it was uncharted territory for everyone. You can kind of forgive them but the second year to get it wrong the second time, that just feels like they don't really care. And ultimately, this is kids' futures that they're talking about.
Yeah.
The next generation of doctors. So it's fair to kind of trust them on that and actually give them a fair test, because we had students who had been preparing for this for the best part of a year and a half.
Yeah, and from a selfish perspective as well, for the medical schools, you know, why would you want your best tool to measure your candidates to be rubbish? Like, what? That's just so... Surely you'd put all your efforts into making sure that is as watertight as possible. But, you know, obviously someone was very reassuring that it would work, and then it didn't.
Yeah, but I think what you said is really poignant, which is it's a shame that the medical schools didn't sit down together. I mean, if they did, at least we weren't made publicly aware of it.
Yeah.
I'm sure there were some conversations we had. But a simplest thing would have just been to just, everyone takes the test again in February.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, obviously that makes problems for people's interview processes, but actually you'd have thought that they'd rather make sure that they were interviewing the right people rather than just making sure they were interviewing someone.
Yeah. And you could put like a conditional on it, couldn't you? So you could give an offer and just that actually this is conditional on you hitting your BMAT scores, and then you kind of save a month of interviewing or extend that interview phase from March to April. So there would be ways around it. I appreciate obviously that starts to eat into research time and Easter time, which is when dons will want to kind of have breaks rather than be worrying about undergraduate admissions. But they're unusual times.
And you know, it works. They already do that for the steps, and that seems to work pretty well.
Yeah, I suppose their retort to that would be they have quotas for medicine. So the GMC puts very strict numbers on how many students each university can accept. Whereas they don't obviously for maths, for instance.
Yeah.
So, but you know, there would be a way of kind of adjusting it. Worst comes to worst, I could do follow the Exeter approach, which was just please defer your entry. Which I'm sure some would be happy with.
I saw the article on that, but I never saw how many, there was never any follow-up in terms of how many students actually did it. Do you know if there was a big uptake on that?
Yeah, I don't actually know. But I think it was just, they had to do it as an choice. So it was quite a lot. It was a few hundred students from my understanding of things.
Yeah. Which, and you know, that's potentially going to make a difference for applications to Exeter this year, right?
Yeah, exactly. And I'm sure the same thing happened for all the other universities, just in a far lesser scale. So we had one student who was offered to request it or incentivize to defer from Birmingham, for instance. So,
No, it is quite interesting that they, how different universities approach it. I guess I don't mind so much the difference of tactic on that front, but I think when it's such an important thing, it should be as unified as possible.
Yeah, so it's a shame that the BMAT wasn't standardized, isn't it? You know, every single university seems to take a different approach. Some just don't care. They just say, look, tough luck. Hopefully you're getting somewhere else. Others will make them sit to modified, like Cambridge will kind of say, let's sit to modified NSAA and so on. So it is a shame, But the BMAT's a really good example of essentially a med school or a course that was so oversubscribed, not just for Oxbridge, that they had to introduce an extra test, which then filtered through and created like a waterfall cascade. So we were obviously we've not talked about the fact that more people are applying every year. So more people applied last year for medicine and Oxford. More people applied this year for medicine and Oxford. I think it's about 20% rises year on year. So ultimately what that means is things are getting more competitive. The number of places at Oxford and med schools isn't increasing in proportion. So the competition ratio has increased. And as competition ratios increase, it gets harder and harder. What that means is it doesn't just get harder at the peak. It also gets harder at the kind of next level below, which is like the Russell Group universities. And we saw this with a long time ago with law. So law was, you know, freakishly competitive to the extent they had to introduce an admissions test. And then the Russell Group universities started using it as well. So the LNAT was adopted by the Russell Group to kind of help filter out. And we've started seeing that recently. I don't know if you saw, but there was a Imperial that recently started introduced their own admissions test for engineering applicants.
For engineers?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, it's the natural next step, right? Again, we've been saying this for years. These admissions tests are only going to become more popular. They're not going to fade out anytime soon. So the engineers took the test this year?
Well, I don't know if they've taken it yet. So it looks like they'll take it next year in February.
Okay.
It doesn't look like engineers might be physics applicants. But, you know, the principle's still the same. The most competitive courses are the most competitive universities. As they get oversubscribed, that has a trickle-down effect to other universities for similar purposes as well.
Yeah, it's not a question of will the other universities, you know, the other top Russell Group unis start using admissions tests. It's more just a matter of when. It's kind of inevitable that it's going to happen. And it will happen for the top courses and the top unis first, but like you say, it will trickle down. It's interesting, you know, I don't know if this is happening. We're so UK-centric in the stuff that we do at uni admissions. I don't know if it's happening in, you know, more internationally, or if it's just the fact that UK universities are seen as so strong that they're preferentially applied to, so they're more competitive.
Yeah, I guess my understanding is in the US, things have become harder as well, especially because they weren't using SATs and ACTs as much. It's a very strange time for students, and I think it creates a lot of uncertainty for them as to where they need to go. I mean, even if we just look back across this year, just to summarize, we found out GCSEs wouldn't matter. We found out the BMAT was essentially a write-off for half the students that took it. We've not even talked about the extra stuff like work experience, but the fact that work experience wasn't a proper requirement for medics as well. New admissions tests were introduced, more students applied. It creates like an environment where essentially it gets harder and harder to kind of secure that place.
Yeah. And we're in a period whereby, you know, we're very used to the fact that the application process changes each year, that sort of bread and butter stuff. But it normally changes in quite subtle ways and in ways which will affect a minority of students and in ways which are relatively easy to pick up on and are announced and can be worked on. Whereas now, actually, we're having changes every year which affects pretty much everyone. It's very difficult to predict what it means and is actually quite a strong effect.
The other thing is, you know, just naturally, based on experiences, what will happen is the admissions tests themselves have to get harder.
So
every year it gets harder and harder. But actually, because of the extra time students have had to prepare for some of these admissions tests, they have to make them more discerning, which means the questions and the complexity of them become greater. As a result, which, you know, it makes sense, but it does put more pressure on the students because we're asking for more and more from them every year. So when I took the BMAT, there was one past paper available. Now there's about 15 years worth. And if you've not done all 15, at least, well, 15 is quite a lot, but if you've not done at least the last 7-8 years worth, at least twice, then you're at a disadvantage compared to your other peers, for instance.
And I guess, you know, the overall long-term idea would be things are getting harder, but that means that the students are stronger. And so they're better when they get in. And so they do better. And so, you know, it's a marker of progress, but it does just mean that it's difficult.
I was speaking to a chap who went to Oxford in the 80s.
Mm.
And he said, actually, if you got 1A and 2Bs, you're pretty much guaranteed to get into to Oxford. There were no, it was like this common test that everyone sat. But it was, you know, it was much, much easier to get in. The ratios were much more favorable as well.
Yeah.
So it's, I think they had about 3,000-4,000 places compared to 6,000-8,000 now. So it's just a huge, huge change.
Yeah. Yeah. But, you know, the whilst a lot of things have changed, people haven't stopped wanting to go and study there. Mm. You know, it's still a very desirable thing to be doing. And actually, it is interesting. I often wonder, well, you know, if their entry requirements were so relaxed back in the old days, how on earth did they, you know, have any fantastic students that did amazing things? But obviously they did.
Well, I think A-levels were different as well back then. The quality of education probably isn't. I think everyone moans about how bad things are now, but actually we've got it pretty good compared to what it used to be 50 years ago.
Yeah, yeah, no, definitely. No, it's certainly, I think, you know, we're seeing a huge change in the ability of state schools to actually be able to give students a really strong start to life, a really strong education. I haven't looked into it, but I anticipate that that's a relatively new thing. Mm. I anticipate that actually, if you weren't, you know, if you don't go to a private school now, you've actually got a really good chance of getting in at one of the top universities if you apply yourself and put in the effort. Whereas back then, I imagine it would have been much, much, much harder and much less common as well.
Yeah, there's certain colleges which almost actively, positively discriminate, that's a phrase
I can
utter, in favour of state school applicants at Oxbridge. And yeah, some med schools are show predilection for them as well. So,
You mentioned you mentioned work experience, which is probably the last thing that is changing or in flux at the moment. Do you have any sense, or do you have any predictions about what's going to happen next year with it?
I don't think things will change with work experience. The reason for it is just impossible to get work experience right now in a clinical setting. This is more for medicine, of course. I think for other subjects, it is much more accessible, but to give you some context, one of my friends was having a baby and he wasn't allowed in to the maternity suite. This was only about 6 months ago.
Yeah.
Because of the COVID restrictions. And this is when things were pretty chilled out compared to what they are now. So it is very, very difficult to have any clinical experience. Yeah. And I just don't see that changing for the next 12 months, because the NHS always lags behind and naturally and rightly so hyper cautious.
Yeah.
And what students sometimes don't realize is the NHS isn't there. The primary purpose of a medical school is to educate you. But once you step into a hospital, the primary purpose of that hospital isn't to educate you. That's a secondary objective. The primary objective is to have good patient outcomes, however that's defined. So even if they do end up in a COVID ward, or in any hospital setting, it's extremely unlikely they'll see anything that would be beneficial to their learning, let alone, you know, I think it's extremely unlikely they'll even be accepted into it. So yeah, I don't think that's going to change for another 12 months, realistically. What the impact of that on med schools? Well, it's going to start showing, I think, because this will be the second year now where students won't have had work experience.
Yeah.
And I think there's quite a lot to be said for work experience, because the best students will always be happy with whatever, you know, they're keen, they want to be a doctor for a while, nothing's going to put them off. But the people in the balance, I think there's quite a few students who get put off by essentially seeing the reality of medicine.
Yeah.
Of course, what you see on TV and read in papers and the news is kind of medicine with rose-tinted glasses, the romanticized version. The reality is very, very different. It's pretty much like, you know, I compare it to like a war, like, you know, people used to kind of say, go to war, defend your country, but actually when you end up in the trenches, it's probably not a very nice place to do. It's very much like that. Less extreme, of course, you know, no one's dying imminently. But the analogy still stands. So I think what we'll probably start seeing, and I hope I'm wrong about this, is a higher rate of dropouts from med school in the next 2 years as students get more clinical experience and realize, actually, this isn't what I signed up for. This yeah. isn't really what I wanted.
Yeah. And of course, that's obviously from an individual level, you've got to do what, if it's not right for you, then, you know, dropping out is an understandable thing. But from an NHS wide level, mm. they're very dependent on X number of doctors graduating each year mm. and filling the gaps, basically. And if they're not able to rely, if that becomes a less and less reliable number, I'm sure it's an unreliable number at the moment, you know, without this mm. dropout rate, but if that's going to become more unreliable, then that is problematic. I mean, what do you think? So students that I've spoken to have done things like, you know, obviously they can't get actual clinical work experience, but they still do as much volunteering as they can. And one of the common ones will be volunteering at mm. a test center or a vaccination center. Mm. Do you think the medical schools might change their sort of policy and say, we're not looking for any clinical work experience, but we still expect X amount of hours volunteering?
Yeah, I think that's a very reasonable. I mean, if I was a clinical dean at any med school, that's probably the first thing I would be kind of looking into to kind of, because mm. essentially you want to test a commitment.
Yeah.
And understanding of the reality of medicine. My trouble with kind of online work experience is that essentially you can just sit from the comfort of your home, you know, potentially fast forward bits that you find boring or don't like. But actually, that's a huge skill that you have to master. And I don't mean this in a kind of pretentious way, but having gone through med school and sat through clinics, which were extremely boring, where you're basically completely ignored and try not to fall asleep and take notes and learn yeah. from it, that's a skill in its own right. And I think if you can kind of just, you know, short circuit that, mm. then that doesn't give you a reality of, you know, what medicine is actually about. It is there. Yes, there's some good bits, but that's probably only for about, depending on the specialty area, you're probably only about 5 to 20% of the work you do is really good and enjoyable.
Mm.
The rest of it is just like with any role, you have yeah. to put in the paces.
Yeah. And I think, you know, obviously a 1 week work experience placement isn't going to give you the full sense of it, but no. it's a hell of a lot better than nothing.
Exactly.
And even if it's just a little taste of, oh, it's not all, you know, amazing. Thank you, doctor. You've saved my life.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
It's not all that. Even if you just know that, at least that's something yeah. which is going to make a difference and hit you with reality.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I can count on my hands how many thank you cards and, you know, presents I've had. And I'm probably one of the lucky ones. Like some of my friends, they're 5, 6 years into medicine now. They've not had a single thank you card. It just doesn't happen very often. But I think, you know, just what you said earlier, there's a lot to be said about just having the stamina to do this. So the thing with work experience online is you could do it across a week and you could just do it in the evenings or on the weekend or according to, you know, how you felt.
Yeah.
When you go into work experience, you put on a badge or an ID badge and you are the representative of the NHS, you are a future doctor, and you have to do whatever's asked for you. So the thing that I found hardest when I became a doctor in the first week wasn't actually, oh my God, I'm looking after so many patients, I don't know what to do. It was actually, God, I'm starting at 8 a.m. and I'm finishing at 9 p.m. and I'm on my feet for yeah. 13 hours a day without the chance to sit down like that. That itself was like quite difficult. It was quite a change of pace to sitting in a library, going through textbooks, going yeah, into the yeah. clinic, sitting in the clinic. So I think that just tells you a lot. You know, can you imagine yourself doing that? But the next closest thing to that is what you said, voluntary work, kind of going through. And I think even if the med schools don't ask for that, any applicant who's like really serious about it would be signing up to this kind of stuff.
Yeah, I think you can tell quite a lot. And it's by what people have been doing in their spare time. Mm-hmm. And obviously it's going to depend based on the medical school you apply to. You know, there are places like Liverpool that say, actually, before we interview you, we don't even read your personal statements. And so if you're the kind of person mm-hmm. who hasn't done any volunteering, you might wonder, well, is this right for me? But if you are going to apply, then you might want to apply to Liverpool. Whereas if you have done tons of volunteering, you want to make sure that that's actually going to come across. And not necessarily because you only did it so that they'd see it, but because if you are doing it, you may as well benefit from it, right? If you put in the hard hours, at least make sure that they see that and can consider that alongside everything else that you've done.
And I guess the other thing is, even if you've not done traditional work experience, just being able to get a better understanding of clinical medicine. So things like, what does an examination look like? What do nurses do? What do healthcare assistants do? What do porters and physiotherapists do? Just having that practical knowledge is a good way of kind of approaching things. And you can get that from just speaking to doctors and nurses. You know? So obviously not everyone will have access to them, but just sitting down for a couple of hours with someone and just saying, hey, can you just talk to me about your job? Like, I know it's not formal experience, but even that, I think, shows
something. Yeah. So a lot of changes, a pretty tumultuous year. And to be honest, I think it looks like next year is going to be more of the same. I don't think either of us think that suddenly everything's going to be better and back to how it was.
It's a shame, right? Because we'd love to be here to say, look, we're past the worst of it now. Things are going to be better. Interviews are going to be in person. The tests are going to be back in paper. Your GCSEs will start counting for the formulas restored. But actually, we're probably in for another year of uncertainty.
Yeah, like you say, it'd be nice to say otherwise, but ultimately if it is going to be uncertain, you're better off knowing that it's uncertain and preparing for everything.
Yeah. And the good thing is students have the time now, more than previous years. Like, you do have the ability. I mean, the other thing we've already talked about is whether A-levels, GCSEs will go ahead next year. I mean, I think that's still pretty much up in the air, depending on how the next few weeks play out.
Yeah, I don't think it's sensible to make any predictions at this point, but I want them to happen, but anything can happen. I'm just not sure where we'll be. We don't even know where we'll be in a month's time, let alone in 6 months' time. But yeah. Okay. Not bad. Exciting times ahead.
Feel bad for the students who are going to have to really work their socks off. But I think it is just an arms race, isn't it? Like, if you're not prepared to do the work that someone else is going to be. So.
Yeah. Any other things from this year worth talking about? I mean, obviously there were lots of things that happened this year, but it to do with applications.
Yeah, I think we've covered the broad brushstrokes of kind of the major changes. We didn't really talk about the format of the interviews for the med schools, but I think that's not really had a huge impact on the way students prepare.
So, yeah.
I think I've always said that the skills for an MMI versus a panel interview are broadly the same. It's just the way you approach them, which differs slightly. So, I know lots of students, med schools went back to panel interviews instead because it's just easier for them to organize.
Yeah, virtually.
Cool. Okay. Well, we should probably start wrapping up. So, any interesting facts you've got for us?
So as you know, I'm currently doing my master's in Southampton.
Yeah.
And I wanted to do a Southampton related fact. Now, I think, with a bit more research, I'm sure there's more things that I can find about Southampton. But one of its claims to fame is that it is where the Titanic set off from. And as you will know, of course, the Titanic sank pretty badly. You could sink less badly, I think. There's all the issues with the lifeboats and the evacuation. It's generally known as a pretty catastrophic disaster. But one thing that I didn't know about the Titanic is that so just over 700 people made it out alive on lifeboats, and about 1% of the survivors were dogs. So you had nine dogs altogether made it off alive.
Is it 1% or 10%? Sorry,
1%.
1%. Okay.
Which is actually quite a large amount. Given
nine people.
Well, I suppose dogs don't quite take up the same space as a person. I mean, the other thing that they say is that the lifeboats had huge amounts of space for more people to get on. So overall, the evacuation effort was just very, very bad. But I could very much answer. I'm a very fond owner of a 9-year-old golden doodle, and I can definitely understand the panic thinking of carrying your dog as you're trying to run away and escape on a ship, and potentially even I would be. Well, you know, you obviously there's no way of telling how you'd act, but I'd like to think that I would put little Alfie on the boat before myself. We'll see how I actually behave in an emergency situation.
That sounds slightly ominous, though.
Well, I'm not planning on having any bad shipwrecks anytime soon, but I'll let you know if there's one in the pipeline.
So essentially they did a botched job of the evacuation as an issue.
Well, so a lot of, there are a lot of things that went wrong. Firstly, so they didn't have as many lifeboats as they should have had. The lifeboats were, you know, people got on the lifeboats, but because there was such a sort of a bit of a panic, they sort of, you know, they'd get about half the people that could fit in it on it, and then they'd drop the lifeboat to sort of get them off and safe. Lots and lots of people ended up just, you know, freezing to death in the water. There was a chef, I think he was a baker on the boat, who obviously, you know, everyone could see the ship was sinking, and his response was to get really, really drunk. So obviously this was a ship laden with stocks of alcoholic drinks. You know, it was a very classy affair, lots of very rich people. I think the richest man on the boat was worth like $2 billion or something along those lines. So this was a very high class affair. And so this baker decided to get really, really drunk, and then was in the water for a few hours and actually survived, because the alcohol thinned his blood so much that the hypothermia couldn't set in. You know, that's what I do. I'd throw my dog onto a lifeboat, and then I'd go and find the liquor cabinet as quickly as possible.
And then dish it out to everyone quickly.
So don't run. Come to me. We can just have a drink. We did actually study it in my A-level psychology as well, because there was another ship that sank called the Lusitania. And I think that sank in a much quicker time than the Titanic sank. So the Titanic hit the iceberg and then was sort of sinking for a really long period. And actually far more people survived the Lusitania. And that the thinking is, because it was a quick sink, there was no time to sort of to do stupid things, and everyone just got on the lifeboats and then they went off. Whereas because there was time, people sort of deliberated and made mistakes and more people died. So that was sort of the comparison was looking at how people behave in sort of emergency situations.
Did they look at the water temperature? That probably had a big thing to do with it.
It's a long time ago. I can't remember, but they probably didn't look at who was drunk as well. That probably makes a big difference.
Yeah, the Titanic's an interesting one because it was, there were two other ships in the same class as the Titanic called the Oceanic and the Britannic.
And what happened to them?
They both sank as well.
They sank as well?
Yeah. So there were three ships launched that were built like the Titanic. So the Titanic was actually one of three.
Yeah.
I think it's remembered because it's probably the most terrible one.
Disastrous, yeah.
But they all sank. And I think essentially their propellers were just so big that they kept drawing things into them. Whereas obviously propellers on ships are very different now. Very, very interesting. If only they'd had a Barbara to kind of usher them into the right places.
Yeah, what a difference.
My fact relates to, I was at home and had a very lazy, lazy day and essentially ordered a delivery to home, which I've never done before.
Okay.
And there weren't many things open. So I was kind of scraping the barrel. So I ordered a Subway. And I thought, okay, well, this is really going to go out here and get a foot long instead. I can have one for dinner.
Mm.
And when it arrived, it looked smaller than I remember them looking.
Right.
And as it happened, I was in the utility room, so I had a ruler. So I actually was a bit of a nerd and measured it. And it was actually only 11 inches instead of 12 inch. So then I was about to kind of call them and say, what the hell? But then I Googled it, and it turns out, I think, so all Subway sandwiches are actually anywhere between 11 inches to 12 inches. And this was such a problem that someone actually took them to court over it.
Naturally. Yeah,
you can see it happening in America. And you know, it was in the New York Post. They measured the actual length of Subway footlongs in New York City, found that the average was actually 11 inches. And then Subway said, well, in regards to the size of the bread and calling it footlong, they said Subway footlong is a registered trademark and is not intended to be a measurement of length. And it went all the way up to a national court. Okay. Whereas eventually the judge ruled in Subway's favor, saying most sandwiches are in fact 1 foot long, but due to perfectly natural and unavoidable vagaries in the baking process, a small fraction are below 12 inches.
Interesting. I mean, it's disappointing, of course. And obviously, I quite like their argument that it's a trademark and not a measurement. That's clever.
Imagine if we could do that, the 100% success program.
It's a trademark. yeah, wow. So does that, I don't suppose you know if the 6-inch, well, I guess it's just half a foot long, isn't it? So it's going to have as much variation as the foot long would.
Yeah, I wonder if that's trademarked. I assume it must be.
Disappointing. Very disappointing. Tut, tut, Subway. Make your sandwiches bigger.
But there you go. Next time you're at Subway, then you know, take a ruler with you.
Yeah, I will. I will make, and I'll send it back if it's not at least 11 and a half inches. I'll allow half an inch variation. That's fine.
It's such a size screen. Cool. Well, catch you later, Will.
Yeah. Have a, you know, fantastic New Year's Eve. And I'll see you in 2022.
Yeah. See you next year.
See ya. Bye-bye.